You're tuned to the great Bayside sounds of 88.3 Southern FM.
On this evening's The Space Show, we invite you to join us as we explore some of the space policy issues that face Australia. This is the third in a series of five programs. There are two speakers this evening, both from the Final Frontier Festival that was held last year at Melbourne University. The festival was organised by the Melbourne Space Program Group. Jason Held will outline the Australian opportunities in space, and Brett Beddington will address the issues which an Australian space policy must address. Here to introduce Jason Held is Joel Patterson, an honours student in international politics at Monash University in Clayton.
Jason Held. Dr. Jason Held, founder of Sabre Astronautics, was a US Army major and Army Space Support Team Leader for US STRATCOM, formerly Space Command, and deployed internationally in support of military space missions. He was a lead instructor at the Inter-Service Space Fundamentals course, and he conducted flight software engineering for the Wide Field Camera 3 of the Hubble Space Telescope and testing for the International Space Station. At the University of Melbourne, he is founded Space Engineering Laboratory, provided leadership for the University CubeSat project, and Australia's first premix rocket engine.
When we talk about the space industry here in Australia, and you know, some of you could tell I'm an American, you know, by background, the accent, you know, has only half morphed over, you know, so I can fool people when I go to the States, they think I'm Irish, give me free beer, which is nice. But I've been here 12 years I've been here. I've been here longer than I've been anywhere else in my adult life. So I've kind of been adopted by you. I married an Aussie and I'm here. So I've listened to all the arguments that we've had in the space industry and the community, and it all tends to talk about the opportunity lost. Okay, we tend to stand up and we say, here, we could have done these things. I wish we had a space agency, but we don't, so let's go back to sleep. I want to change that argument a little bit. I want to talk about the space industry in terms of disruption, in terms of the opportunities of the future, and in many cases, the opportunities of the present, which many of you in this room can handle and be a part of yourselves. You don't have to wait for a government to do it. You can, and you should, and you better do it. All right? Because it's a decision to make. Do I be a part of this? Do I not? Do I sit back and think about it? Or do I actually do something? All right. So first of all, I said the word disruption. That's got a fairly particular term. All right. So what is a disruption? For me, a disruption is a technology which has a change on the behavior of the general population. Okay. So behavior, we're talking about the way you act here on the downstream if you're not a space person. But if you are a space person, it changes the behavior of your purchasing patterns, which is something I think we can take advantage of right now. All right, so to do that, we have to examine what's actually happening here in Australia. So where are we at? I sat back, I thought of it. All right, so Australia, we, depending on who you talk to, it's about $3 to $5 billion per year that we spend on space stuff, right? So we do have an industry. We're spending money, a pretty reasonable chunk of money. And what is stuff? Stuff is mostly, not exclusively, but mostly data of some sort. And that data is used for one or two different categories. It's used for government. So, you know, naval, firefighting, imagery, communications, things of that nature. And it's used commercially, right? So you got this national infrastructure part, and you've got the increasingly important for commercial infrastructure as well. So what are we talking about? We're talking about the growth of Internet of Things, of which Australia is one of the global leaders of it. You've got Australia, Silicon Valley, you know, Technion out of Israel, a lot of technologies and IT and web come out of these places. A lot of these technologies for Internet of Things are being used in water utilities, smart cities, mining, agriculture, all those sort of key touch phrases that if you're writing a grant here in Australia, you got to put these things because it's part of our national requirement to use. However, if you think about it, all that money that we're spending on space stuff is all on import of goods or services from overseas, okay? So, example, the NBN Co., who made that satellite?
Brown.
Okay, did we make it? How much of that did we make? None. All right. So of any of the satellites that are used by Optus, which is one of the other large space systems, who makes that? Okay. So what does that mean? We're on an agreement with the United States where if we buy one of the satellites from overseas, we don't even get the schematics. We can't use it, right? So if there's something wrong with one of those satellites, you have to go back to the supplier out in the States. So look, not a very good scenario and for Australians, but still there's a bit of American in me. So I have to say on behalf of the United States of America, I want to thank you for your contribution to my space program. Great. No, don't clap. No, don't clap to that. I hope this recording doesn't go back to my friends in the States. Don't tell anyone, right? Don't tell anyone. I want to be able to live here and do my craft. I want to be able to live in Australia and do my job without having to move. That's my personal goal. That's why I founded Sabre Astronautics. But look, these decisions are very conscious decisions that have been made in government levels, at commercial levels, and if you think about it tactically, for many years, they have been very sound technical decisions. Even 5 years ago, I was like, all right, I kind of understand why they're doing it for all the reasons that it's expensive to produce and launch a satellite. You know, it's hundreds of millions of dollars. It's a major infrastructure. And let's face it, if somebody else is doing it, the insurance and the risk is on them. And if somebody else is doing it, then we could probably arrange some sort of defense collaboration arrangement, which kind of works in our favor in certain respects, right? So, you know, I'm not going to go hard on the government for the decisions they made. They were good decisions for the time they were in. But the result we all feel here at the ground level, right? And I call it the Australian space checkmate problem, right? So we have this import economy of $3 to $5 billion a year, and everything has been structured to support that economy, right? That import economy. So we give tax breaks, pretty massive tax breaks, if we import space goods from overseas. Pretty cool, huh? You two can have a dish, right? And you get a tax break for that. We got nothing for export. We got no support for export specifically for space. We got some things for export elsewhere, but for space we don't have anything. We have this regulatory structure that protects that relationship as well. And ITAR is a part of it. Yes, there is a really good need for... If you don't know what ITAR is, it means that I, as an American citizen, if I sell my product to the wrong person in the wrong way, I get a $500,000 fine and 5 years in jail. Right? So it's serious. So any business in Australia working with businesses in the United States, it's all designed to send stuff out, right? And our culture, we could feel it in this very room. When we talk about our own industry here, there's that kind of feeling, we can't do it, or somebody else has to do it, somebody else, no. So all of that is kind of a result of our history. So that means we get few local suppliers, few local buyers. It's too hard a barrier to entry to become a supplier of space goods here in Australia. It's just too hard. In order for someone to buy your product, you have to actually fly it. Otherwise, they don't care. And it doesn't matter how good of a research program you have at a university. If it's not going up into space, nobody's going to want to buy it. All right? So that kind of brings that circle of unlife together as well. So, look. Sabre, we went to the United States. We got a lab out in Denver. It's very small. We got a small lab in Sydney. And we went out and we started selling our wares and introducing ourselves reintroduction in my case. The feedback I got was, all right, that tech looks great, but you're Australian. You don't do space. You got no space program. Sorry, I got these other companies I'm going to focus on over here. But we got exceptional brand recognition for universities. Okay, so what that means is, culturally, America has a habit of buying from Americans. Europeans have a habit of buying from the Europeans. The Australians have a habit of buying only from the Americans or the Europeans. We don't buy from ourselves, which is kind of weird, but it's true. But the universities are quite interesting because a lot of the grant structure here in Australia is not designed to put money into small businesses, designed to put money into the university, which, again, sensible decision. Universities are good at research. So the scenario is, if the Americans or Europeans want to play with us, we are great, ripe acquisition ground, right? So they come out here, put $30,000 into a university, you get a free PhD student, and work out an IP arrangement where they get to keep the IP, bring it back to the United States. But, God forbid, if we want to make something ourselves, now we're in competition. So That's the bad news. The good news is that the game has changed. Okay, now this should not be a surprise to anybody in this room, but just to recap, old space, right, big space, you could do a whole lot with the common commercial spacecraft. $50 million to $500 million is the cost. You could do a lot with that. But there's a whole new group of form factors called CubeSats that range in size either from this big to this big. You know, they, 10 centimeter cube is called a 1U. I'm not going to harp on what it actually is. You can't do as much individually with the satellite, a CubeSat, that you can with these large spacecraft. Okay? But look at the price point. Cost $200,000 to start your own space company these days. And I'm seeing them happen all over the place, right? Think about it. $200,000. That's less than the cost of a Boost Juice franchise. All right? Boost Juice franchise is $600,000 to franchise Boost Juice, right? Yeah, you could have three of these suckers flying around. Anyways, so just by the mathematics, you would say, okay, there's an opportunity here that we could take advantage of. We could certainly do that here in Australia, and you're starting to see the early stages of what I call the democratization of space. So people are who you don't have to be rich. You can go to a bank, get a small business loan. You need a decent business plan to do that. You could get angel investment funding, and people do this. But people who are not traditionally PhDs, you know, like some of us up here who have heritage, people who love space like you do, who have an entrepreneurial spirit, maybe a hacker kind of a spirit, get some friends together and form a company. And we're seeing a lot of this happening around the world in places like London, Moscow, Tel Aviv, Silicon Valley, San Diego, Sydney, Adelaide, Melbourne. It's happening. So what are they doing? One of two things. Remember that first slide I said, what Australia spends money on? Well, seems to be that's what everybody else is spending money on as well. You've got imagery to take pictures of the Earth, and this is a spacecraft company out of California that raised about $200 million. They started small with $200,000 and then increased and, you know, showed their worth and raised more. They get about 3 to 5 meters per pixel off of this camera, all right? Which is pretty good. It's the lower end of the satellite imagery market. So not as good as what you're going to get out of these guys, right? So you're not going to be able to count the number of cars at Walmart from space. But you could certainly count the number of ships, all right? So you could do naval, anti-piracy, agriculture, mining, all these things we care about here. And the important bit, rapid advancement, lean manufacture for spacecraft. Assembly lining for spacecraft, very rare. Okay, there may be two or three other constellations in the world that do it. The reason why this is a new area and it's important is because if you produce 100 satellites, you can experiment in ways you haven't if you could only produce one satellite for $500 million. Okay? I talked to the team, the ops team out at this company, and they tell me if they get bored and they got a new algorithm, they just try it out. I got a spare satellite. Hey, I got this thing. I'll upload it. Hey, let's try it out. That didn't quite work. So experimentation means rapid advancement of technology in a way that we haven't seen since the computer disruption. Personal computers. That's the same kind of path we're expecting. All right. And on the right, SATCOM. Now, 2 years ago, I said, all right, SATCOM, that's much harder. It's going to be a few years down the track. I was pretty much right on track with when this was going to happen. I was very wrong with this one. It's actually happening right now. I've seen two companies in Australia alone, in Adelaide alone, both of whom got their seed funding for 100 satellites to do communications for low volume bandwidth. All right. So, and look, these guys are going to make hundreds of millions of dollars with it, right? And it's pretty cool. All right. So, anyways, so that's really the sign of a disruption is you have one, an opportunity, you got a technology, you have people taking advantage of the technology that have never taken advantage of it before. I whacked a couple of logos up on this slide, just friends of mine that I know are doing it. These are just Australians. This is only the tip of the iceberg. If your company should be on here, let me know. I apologize if it's not on here. I put this together in a minute. But the point is, this is already happening in Australia. There are at least 20 startups that are working together. Of these, these guys down here have gotten seed funding. Some of these up here got seed funding and customers. These guys just did a very small but successful Kickstarter. So there are a lot of different ways that you can start from nothing and actually do something with it, all right? All right, so that's what I call the first bump. So a disruption happens in waves. You get a peak, and then you finish with the peak, and then you get another one when there's a new technology at the end of the day. The peak that we're in right now has not yet started. All right, we're at the first year of what I think is a four-year curve. All right, the second one after that I think is going to happen anywhere from 3 years to 10 years. And this is kind of where I start looking into the looking glass a bit. And the further out you go, the more wrong you could be. So forgive me a little bit as I explore science fiction. But 3D printing is brand new. It's on the ISS. You've proven that you can do it. Astronauts have made the very first tools. But what we're seeing are the plans for very large structures for 3D printing. We're seeing technology where you could 3D print electronics, 3D print all these things. So you're looking at the potential not to launch your own spacecraft, but to 3D print your own spacecraft straight from the ISS. All right, which means the cost of a space mission is going to go down from $200,000 to $30,000. All right, so that means even more people can get involved. That's a friends and family round. Hey, you know, mom, dad, you know, can you give me some cash? Hey, Joe, my wife, hey, put in $5,000 here and there, and you have that in no time, and you have your business. This picture on the right is actually old news. This is from 2013. That's the first 3D printed rocket engine, and that was firing at I don't remember how hot it was, like 3,000 degrees Kelvin, massive hot for 3D printing. You're talking about rapid reduction in cost for very large spacecraft components. All right. Third bump, really going out there, just having fun. You've got three different categories. Mining, where you're looking at logistics. You're looking at solar sails. The first demonstration prototype was flight tested. I think it was last year. And you've got reusable launch. Of course, that's much more mature. That's already running. You're talking about much greater operational freedom. So now you're not changing the satellite itself, you're changing the way you use it, right? And in particular, I'm quite excited to see this technology move forward, solar sails, because it means instead of doing an orbit and revisiting customers, you can kind of sail and hold in place and look at the same customers at the same time. It changes the way you interact with people, okay? And all right, so we're near the end of this talk. So the question I have for you is, what do we do about it? Okay. We here in Australia have things that we can do. We've had the argument in the past of we can't. Let's put it aside for a minute because the environment is now different than it was even 5 years ago. Okay. We need to build a local supply channel. This needs to be done with an entrepreneurial spirit. And oh, by the way, when I say that, I have to caveat a bit with a warning. 90% of all startups fail. Okay, so if you're thinking about doing it, it's a real rough ride. Some of my friends in here are doing it, know what I'm talking about. But more importantly, we need a community, okay? A community of people who are buying and selling from each other. We need to kind of break that cycle of only going back to an outside supplier when we've got some really exciting companies that are young and scrappy and working hard out here to do it, okay? So that's why I put this out here. Buy Australian, go Dick Smith. All right. So if the government is listening to this, and I do reach out on occasion, I put some advice their way. Some things the government should do is start taxing imports. Boy, is that going to be an unpopular thing with lobbyists. 20% is probably too high. I'm adopting a model I saw in India. The Indians tax any import for software. I think we could imply the same strategy. It worked for them. It could work for us. But probably at a 5%, not 20%. We have to require local suppliers in the channel. That's definitely not happening. There's a cartel related to the top prime contractors. They're going to protect their supply channels for sure. We need to drastically simplify the launch authority. Right now, if you want to launch a spacecraft, it needs a sign-off from the Minister of Innovation. And as long as you're only launching one or two satellites a year, it's not a big deal. But if you're trying to do anything at volume, like some of these companies out of Adelaide that are launching 100 at a time, that man is going to be busy. Look, couple of funding changes we could do, obviously, changing the grant structures. Of course, I completely agree with what you said. It should be, you should be going for customers, not grants anyways. But more importantly is we got to be more customer-focused and think in terms of acquisition program for businesses and government sales. So that's really it. I put this down here just as a thought experiment, and maybe it's time for a space agency to help coordinate that. That's probably going to spark more debate than I personally can handle. But it's about time we start thinking about it. It's about time we start thinking about it. Start thinking about a space agency to handle that relationship a bit more than is handling now, because nobody really knows where to go. All right. So look, that's the conclusion, three takeaways. If you remember anything at all from this, let's go from import economy to an export economy. That's the first thing we got to do. Entrepreneurial spirit, and here's the key, fly early, fly often. If you're thinking about doing this, don't say I'm going to make a spacecraft in 4 years. Do it in a year. If it's your first spacecraft, it's a year. If it's your second or third or fourth, it's 6 months. Okay, that's the time scale you should be thinking. You should be very aggressive at that. And I want you to understand that this is an opportunity that is happening now. This disruption is happening now. It's early enough days that if we start today and band together, we can take advantage of it. If you wait, then the condition we have right now will not change. If you get involved now, it will definitely change. Because 90% of this growth for CubeSats is supposed to be in Southeast Asia, right? So that's the question for you. Are we ready to do it or are we not? That's all I got to say. Thank you very much for your time.
That was Jason Held, the founder of Sabre Astronautics in Sydney, with his view of the opportunities that space offers Australia. Well, judging by this year's federal budget, I don't think that Scott Morrison was listening.
The Space Show, bringing the universe home to the Bayside, Wednesday evenings at 7 p.m.
On this, the third of our Space Show specials on Australian space policy issues, we are at Melbourne University and the Final Frontier Festival. A panel of experts are debating the topic, the politics behind space in Australia. Joel Patterson of Monash University's Clayton campus announces our next speaker.
Brett Biddington. Brett Biddington owns a space and cybersecurity consulting company and is leading the delivery team for the International Astronautical Congress in Adelaide in 2017. He's director of the Institute for Regional Security, a Canberra-based think tank, and also the Space Environment Research Cooperative Research Centre, or CERC. He holds adjunct professorial appointments at the Edith Cowan and RMIT universities and was admitted as a member of the Order of Australia for services to the Australian space sector in 2012.
So, ladies and gents, I'm going to firstly absolutely endorse what Owen has said about cringe and all those sort of things that we are so common talking about ourselves as a society and a culture. Talk down our capabilities, unduly modest, knock-down tall poppies, all that sort of stuff. Jason is also right in saying that we're at an inflection point. What I want to do, though, is perhaps try to explain why our story has been the way it is, taking the national security perspective on this. So it's not to disagree with what our two previous speakers, Owen especially, though, talking about, grumbling about why we fail. That's part of it. But I think there's another part of the story, too, that we need to understand, because only when that context is in place can we really figure out how we're going to take this forward. So firstly, this slide. All of the world's major space agencies, the capital cities of the nations that have that are major space players, are not just north of the equator, which is not where that red line is, but they're north of the Tropic of Cancer, which is where the red line is. Space, historically, has been a northern hemispheric activity, and today remains so. And indeed, even if all of those small companies grab the opportunity that Jason says, and I agree with him, exists, still space is a northern hemispheric activity, which is why Jason's absolutely right when he says if we want to succeed in this business, we have to be thinking about export. Our market is not big enough locally to sustain what otherwise we would seek to do. Just a snapshot of who's in space today. There are about 1,300. This is 2015 data. But since then, we have about 1,300 operating satellites. You can see there the breakup in the countries, the big three, and then a lot of others. And then in low Earth, medium Earth, elliptical, in geostationary orbits, so different orbits. And then what they're used for, civil, commercial, government and military applications. And you can see here that the United States still is predominant in space. A few years ago, every dollar, about 66 cents of every dollar spent in space was spent one way and another by the United States. That now figure is coming down to about 50 cents. As other nations step up their own interests and investments in satellites and in being in space. For my money, and this has certainly been the case till today, and I would argue this will remain the case for a long time to come, space is the high ground of peace and war. It has always been thus. The V2 started this, we now use it for treaty monitoring. It's linked inextricably the way that we've developed space during the 1950s, 60s, and even use it today with the whole question of nuclear weapons. And Australia, of course, has been part of that. And the next few slides take this a little bit further. The other point I want to make, and this picks up on something Owen said, Australia is actually a pretty big place, but with a paradox of a very small population. He says, well, Canada's like that too. I agree with that, but there is a distinction, and that is that this country is responsible for about 15% of the Earth's surface, about 12% of the Earth's oceans. Canada does not have that responsibility, and also it doesn't have to worry about the sort of contested political environment as we do because of our place on Earth. The former NASA representative to Australia, Neil Newman, used to talk about the attraction of Australia to NASA. He said, frankly, we don't give a shit about Australia much except that it's there, bare and fair. And they were the three bits that gave NASA the confidence to do what it's done in Australia over many years in terms of investing in its ground stations and ground infrastructure. Radio quietness in the continent really matters, and that's, of course, why we are pretty good in this country, not just at investing in radio astronomy infrastructure, but then in using that infrastructure to find all sorts of things out about the far universe. The other point about our strategic geography, some of you will recognise this very famous diagram from Arthur Clarke in 1945. He realised that three satellites equidistant around Earth in the geostationary ring, providing they were supported by ground stations, could see basically all but the very, very extreme polar regions. Well, if you have ground stations in Europe, in the United States and in Australia, they can then control satellites in geostationary or geosynchronous orbits above the equator that can see those parts of the world. And that means that in the case of Australia, there has been an absolute relationship between our strategic geography on Earth and the way that satellites work in space. So now let me go back to the end of World War II and coming out of the end of World War II. We had the Woomera programs. Our great and powerful friend is London and the United Kingdom. The legacy of the Woomera programs was not much in the way of IP, although things like NOLCA came out of Woomera. Who knows about the NOLCA story? Not many people at all. But by and large, this is, if you like, one of the lost opportunities. The real legacy is institutional. We had a very damaging leaks from the highest levels of the Labor government, the Chifley Labor government in the late 1940s, which led ultimately to the Petrov Royal Commission, which ultimately led to the collapse of the Labor Party and the split in the 1950s, for those people who are old enough to remember that stuff. But go back to the 1940s, the Americans realising that we had a massive breach of trust at a highest level of government, basically turned off the technology tap and said it wouldn't be turned back on until we took our own security in hand, and that led to the creation of ASIO. The other legacy, as Owen's mentioned, is our Defence Science and Technology Group, not organisation, as the slide says. So the sort of technology transfer that could have happened perhaps didn't at the levels that we would have hoped. Today, and since the 1960s, when the Brits moved out and the Americans moved in, they were very concerned, of course, to use our radio quietness, our geostrategic position to host some pretty important, from their point of view, ground infrastructure for ballistic missile early warning, which was the Narunga base near Woomera, and the Narunga base has now been replaced by two remote antennas. They're the two little antennas that you can see on the left-hand side of the screen at the back of the Pine Gap base in Alice Springs. And Pine Gap remains one of the most important intelligence-gathering facilities in the Western world. These bases, of course, have not been without controversy. Des Ball was the author in the 1980s who really tried to explain to the Australian people what it was that these places did and do. He was considered by governments and defence organisations at the time to have been somewhat traitorous for even talking about this stuff in public, but he felt that it was pretty important that Australians understood what it was that was happening on our soil and what we were supporting. And indeed, we eventually had ministers say that, you know, in the event of nuclear war, Pine Gap probably would be a target, and that's something that the people of Alice Springs should have been a little concerned about. We've had a succession of defence white papers since 1987. 1985-86, Paul Dibb conducted a review of the Australian Defence Force, a soup to nuts, back to basics review. Essentially, the Defence Force that we had to that point was very much a marginally modernised force coming out of World War II. Tactically focused, no capacity for the Air Force, the Navy and the Army to work very well together, and we saw that in Vietnam, and frankly, not having thought about what it was that we wanted our Defence Force to do. Dibb wrote a report that ended up in the 1987 White Paper as a pretty seminal and important document, and remains so. You can see that since then we've had six White Papers, four by Labor governments, two by Liberal governments. The 2013 White Paper was an absolute pie-in-the-sky document. We were going to have the world because there was this concern of China. We have far more balanced, I think, document that was released earlier this year. Now, bear that in mind. These are the references to space and satellites, just the words in those documents. Basically, we weren't even thinking about space up until 2009 in terms of our explicit national security within the defence context. These white papers are where we sort of say all that stuff. You can see the most recent white paper, a massive jump in the numbers of the use of the word space, and almost invariably linked to the word cyberspace. So space and cyber have now been conjoined in strategic thinking in defence, and if they would think a little more beyond that, this is now utterly transformational in the context of what the Defence Force has to look like in the future if it's to deal with the sorts of threats that are now foreshadowed by the use of these words. space junk, changing tack a little is something that concerns us all, because in the low Earth orbits, if we're not careful about how we tidy up the low Earth orbits, some of them will become unusable by 2030. So critical dependencies that we take for granted from satellites in low Earth orbits. Problem here with the CubeSats, thousands of CubeSats only adds to the confusion here. How long are they going to stay in space for? How do they get deorbited? There are a whole lot of issues yet to be resolved around the cleanliness of the space environment, or the threats to the cleanliness of the space environment. It's pretty grubby at the moment anyway, that CubeSats and small satellites represent. Some companies say we've got it fixed, trust us. There are some rules starting to be written around these things, but it's a confused space. The Chinese didn't help the cause when in 2007 they basically conducted an anti-satellite test, which means that they fired a rocket from the ground and blew up one of their old working satellites, one of their old defunct satellites. They created a massive debris cloud. A little while later, there was a collision between Iridium working communication satellite in low Earth orbit and a defunct Russian communication satellite. And a little while later, the Americans shot down one of their own classified satellites to make the point, I think, that you could actually deorbit something without creating a huge debris field like the Chinese had done, and at the same time making sure that this pretty fancy piece of technology couldn't fall into the wrong hands. But it was all done under some sort of guise of we didn't want to have nasty hydrazine or whatever in the atmosphere. So Australia is investing in learning about space situational awareness and contributing to space situational awareness understanding, certainly in the West. In 2012, the US-Australian OSMIN talks, and in 2010 is when it started, there was a very public discussion between the two countries. They've agreed to cooperate on space situational awareness. We did the same with the Brits in 2011. And Australia, again, has some pretty unique advantages geographically to support ground-based sensors and southern hemisphere, south of North Asia, China especially. So we've now installed, at least the Department of Defence has, that radar that has been brought from Antigua across to Northwest Cape. And there are also a couple of space telescopes that have been put there as well. We've also been active diplomatically, but there's been a thing called the Space Code of Conduct, which is something that's lesser than treaties, but that might actually lead us to some good behaviour in space. Those talks have stalled. Russia and China in the last 2 years, Russia especially, just says niet. And there's some good reasons for that, which go back to arguments about the Ukraine and some behaviour there that we all lament. But at about that time, there was a hardening of Russian attitudes about a whole lot of stuff. And frankly, we've got to figure out how to break that intransigence to come to some common understandings in order that we can keep the space environment at least clean enough to be operationally useful. So the Space Environment Research Centre is a cooperative research centre based in Canberra. I'm a director, as I think was said earlier, and basically Electro-Optic Systems plus RMIT plus ANU plus some others have joined together, and the idea of this cooperative research centre is to basically at the end, be in a position to fire a laser at a piece of space junk, so something that is uncontrolled, but where we know where it is with exquisite precision, and then use laser pressure from the ground to move that object just enough that it won't collide with another object. That's the end game of this CRC. And the idea of moving something is to hopefully overcome the problem that you have if you use other sorts of methods of dealing with space debris. Because basically anything that is about removal, capture, or whatever that we might think about, using nets, using spears, using your garbage truck is my space weapon. And it's really, really difficult to distinguish between the two. And if the technology's hard, the politics only gets harder. And that's why this CRC is doing something a little different by saying, well, we're going to leave it all up there, but if we can nudge stuff around, at least for the moment, we can perhaps keep the space environment in the low Earth orbits usable until we can figure out how to perhaps behave better amongst ourselves as nation states and come to some better agreement. This policy was brought out when Julia Gillard was Prime Minister. The current government won't have a bar of it. You're not allowed to refer to it. You're not allowed to sort of the current government, the government that was current. And we'll see what happens tomorrow, I guess, but in caretaker mode today. The point I want to make about this, though, is the giggle factor. This policy is called Australia's Satellite Utilisation Policy. It went into Cabinet called the Australian Space Policy. And in Cabinet, the name was changed. Space is a dirty word in government for a whole lot of reasons that we don't have time to go into today. But in an electoral, contested political environment, can you imagine what would have happened had the Gillard government announced that we were going to have a national space policy, just as about she's losing her prime ministership, the economy is turned south after the saviour of the GFC and all that sort of stuff, the cartoonists would have had a field day. You can imagine the cartoonists putting Julia in a spacesuit with a big thing out the front for her nose and a big thing out the back for her bum, because that's the way the cartoonists portrayed her, rudely and crudely and all that. That's the sort of stuff that governments really fear about. Some of you have been to the Space Science Education Centre out here at Strathmore College. The number of ministers who go to that place and want to get their picture taken on the Mars surface, and their mind just says, Minister, no way, because that'll get out on social media, Minister on Mars. The only newspaper that can get away with this is the Northern Territory News. And a couple of weeks ago, there was an announcement made that Sea Launch might be home-ported in Darwin. Let me tell you, pigs might fly, but that's another story too. But guess what? Front page of the Northern Territory News, the Chief Minister dressed up like one of the Star Wars characters from memory. I mean, hello. Welcome to the Northern Territory. The Australian space sector, tiny, however we talk about it, but opportunities to grow, as we've also had explained. They, for my money, are the enduring drivers for Australia's involvement in space, our geography, our alliance relationships, commitment to international law, brackets when it suits us, and cost. And I think this is where Jason's right. Some of those things aren't going to go away. They're sort of things that governments worry about. What Jason's really saying is, let's just get on and do it. And actually, I think government is getting that message and is keen to try to help. We're going to have some hellishly hard arguments with us, with our government and our government with the United States about technology release. If we want to create an export industry, space technologies are very, very tightly protected under export control rules, so there are some big laws to be got through there. But they're the sorts of things that I would argue we need to start to do. And if we do start to do those things, we make good progress. My last slide, the little logo there is to remind you all that one of the reasons that I guess I'm here is that I led the bid that won us the International Astronautical Congress for Adelaide next year, which will be the world's largest space conference. 3,500 people will turn up, 20-odd astronauts or former astronauts, heads of space agencies. It's an opportunity, as far as I'm concerned, for the Prime Minister to make some serious announcement about space in an audience where the giggle factor doesn't apply and where he can actually start to set a roadmap for these guys to succeed. I wouldn't have put my time on the line to deal with this conference had I not felt that we could make a difference in terms of the narrative. What we've had is a disconnected, classified narrative, which I've described briefly, which has been, we've been so reluctant at the political level to talk, to even take into our confidence our own people, what we did at Woomera, what we do at Pine Gap, what we've done at Narunga. We've been so reluctant to talk about that stuff that we have a group of uninformed, unhappy, disaffected, disenfranchised people who say, why don't we have a civil and a commercial space sector? At the strategic level, as I think Jason said, government has actually made some pretty good decisions. As taxpayers, our strategic interests have been very well met with very little investment. But the times are a-changing, and the opportunities for us to take that. Thank you.
Thank you, Brett.
Speaking at the Final Frontier Festival, that was Brett Beddington. Brett is the owner of Beddington Research Proprietary Limited, a Melbourne space company. Well, this has been the third of five Space Show programs exploring the space policy issues that Australia needs to address. The series has been researched, written, narrated, and produced by Andrew Rennie.